case this morning, which is United Fire and Casualty versus Prate Roofing. All right, we have Ms. Wheeler looking for Mr. Miller.
Your Honor, if I may, Mr. Miller was on, but it looks like he may have just now dropped off.
I see his name.
There he is.
You can see him, but we cannot yet. There he is.
Your Honor, I'm here.
All right, wonderful. Thank you. You may proceed whenever you're ready.
May it please the court, counsel. I am David Miller, spelled the hard way, M-U-E-L-L-E-R. Here on behalf of the Appellant, United Fire and Casualty Company. At the outset, I want to point out that this is essentially the same case involving the same imputed liability endorsement as this court enforced in Liberty Mutual versus a statewide insurance company. I want to direct the court's attention to the only intervening circumstances of significance since the decision of in Liberty Mutual. It was this court's decision in the Aguirre versus Turner Construction Company to the effect that imputed liability or vicarious liability does not exist under section 414 of the restatement second of torts. It is significant that section 414 is the basis for construction negligence claims since 1995 going forward following the repeal of the Illinois Structural Work Act. Aguirre was then adopted by the Illinois Supreme Court in Kearney versus Union Pacific Railroad Company, in which the court said,
Mr. Miller, excuse me, I understand you to be arguing, in essence, that there's no way that Prate Roofing could lose on the merits because of these changes in Illinois law. But I'm not sure how that really addresses the duty to defend issue, particularly in light of the Pekin insurance cases in Centex Homes and Lexington Station, where essentially this problem seems to have been addressed and resolved in favor of finding a duty to defend.
Your Honor, I am not in any sense exonerating Prate. As the court well understands, there was a settlement of the plaintiff's cases involving All Seasons, and that settlement was of the contribution claims of Prate against All Seasons. And by that settlement, All Seasons was released from any liability, and Prate remained as liable for Prate's own proportionate share of the common liability. And that's what we refer to as fault apportionment. Neither the Centex case nor the Lexington Station case either addressed or had anything to do with fault apportionment or contribution. We point out that the complaint in this case specifically is brought under a section 414. It is not an agency claim. If you are going to allege an agency right to recover, as the Kearney case says, then you've got to make allegations to support an agency claim. In Carney, the court specifically refused to consider an agency claim because there were no allegations to that effect. And that is essentially consistent with this court in the Aguirre in recognizing the difference
between the allegations. Excuse me, Mr. Miller, but the allegations we have here seem to be broad enough, don't necessarily pick a theory in the Ayala Estates underlying complaint. And so I guess I just don't quite understand your confidence that there couldn't possibly be any vicarious liability imposed on Prate from the outset of this case.
Okay, let me address that in the context, and I would specifically direct the court's attention to the complaint filed by Devon Bank, which appears in our appendix at page 38. As the Illinois Supreme Court took great pains to do in distinguishing between 414 direct negligence liability and what is required for agency exposure, it pointed out that under section 414, there is a duty on the part of a controlling defendant to exercise reasonable care, and liability results from the failure to do so. In other words, to exercise control with reasonable care. That is direct liability under section 414. The complaint here is limited to a 414 theory. Paragraph 4 of the complaint posits the only duty being the duty on the part of Prate to exercise reasonable care in the control of said construction site. Therefore, the only theory is a direct negligence theory against Prate under section 414 of the restatement second of torts.
Mr. Mueller, it's Judge Scudder. Don't you have to read paragraph 4, though, in connection with paragraph 5 of the complaint? And paragraph 5 of the complaint contains some of that agency language. And paragraph 5 of the complaint then has a serial listing of alleged negligent acts or omissions. And just reading that, those allegations, I don't know whether any of it can be proven, but just reading the allegations, it sure seems to suggest vicarious liability for Prate Roofing on the basis of its failure to do those itemized things there in the complaint.
And that is direct negligence on the part of Prate Roofing. That is not...
go ahead, Judge Hamilton.
Doesn't that point depend upon who is included among in the phrase by and through its agents, servants, and employees?
Well, those allegations, as the court is well aware, and we as practicing lawyers in the litigation, amount to nothing more than boilerplate conclusions.
There's a reason they're boilerplate, though, and that's because, as the Illinois Appellate Court pointed out in the Pekin cases, the person making those allegations, the underlying plaintiff, is rarely going to have good information at the time of filing that complaint about the relationships among the various contractors. And so, of course, they're going to keep it broad because they don't know how defendants may try to point the finger at each other.
Well, let me posit this, which I know to a certainty that there has never been, and I was defending cases under the Illinois Structural Work Act, trying and appealing them, and I did the amicus brief in the Carney case on behalf of the Illinois Chamber of Commerce on this exact point. There has never been a case in which a plaintiff prevailed on an agency theory under section four, under any standard. Plaintiff's lawyers do not allege agency causes of action because the burden of proof is far more difficult than that for a recovery for direct negligence under section 414. In our reply brief, we put in the whodats, there is not one single person in the underlying case that is making a claim that there is an agency relationship. In fact, as the court is aware,
Mr. Miller, let me ask you, for, you know, you've described as a fiction the notion that the duty to defend is broader than the duty to indemnify. I frankly, that's in your reply brief. I had thought that was pretty much black letter law. But let's suppose an underlying plaintiff is trying an entirely new theory for vicarious liability, even acknowledges at the outset that they're seeking a ruling in which they're ultimately going to be asking the Illinois Supreme Court to overrule controlling precedent that would otherwise make their claim impossible. Under those circumstances, do you think an insurer can say, nope, we've got no duty to defend because controlling law says there's no vicarious liability here?
I do where they do as we did in this case, and that is file a declaratory judgment action in order to exonerate the exclusion, not exclusion, but rather the lack of coverage under the insuring agreement. As this court said in the produce versus transportation co, it is the actual complaint, not some hypothetical version, that must be considered. And the Illinois Supreme Court said the same thing. We're not even going to look at an agency theory which isn't alleged. And under the Illinois Code of Civil Procedure, any theory has to be supported by facts. Section 2603 says which are concisely alleged, and if you're going to have an alternative theory, such as the court posited, or based upon agency, then you've got to specifically allege the facts which establish an agency theory. That is incumbent upon the plaintiff. What I don't understand though is
I understand that you're saying that Prate should have a great defense to any such claim. What I don't understand is why you don't have a duty to file the motion for them. I also had a question about the extent to which you're relying upon the Illinois Code of Civil Procedure, particularly since the Ayala estate filed its action in federal court subject to the federal rules of civil procedure.
I mean, I am addressing those in reverse order. I understand the court's concerns in that regard, but if we're relying upon the rule in the Syntex and the rule in Lexington Station, we have to look at the pleadings wherein those claims were considered. And if we're looking at Illinois law as posturing the claims, then there must be separate counts and there must be precision in the pleading itself. So
do you think that the Illinois Code of Civil Procedure governs this question?
As far as this case is concerned, no. As far as the question overall is concerned, since we're focusing upon substantive Illinois law, as far as the duty to defend is concerned, I believe that the answer is yes. The Illinois Supreme Court has consistently said that, number one, there is no such thing as implied indemnity, which would be the conclusion here if there were to be any consideration of a vicarious liability recovery based upon an agency theory. And as we point out, you cannot have a contribution claim, which by definition is fault apportionment, in the context of an agency theory, because contribution presupposes that both the contributee and the contributor pay their fair share, whereas vicarious liability presupposes indemnity.
Multiple tortfeasors instead of imputed liability.
And that is what Illinois and the Illinois Supreme Court, ever since 1978 in the Skinner case, has said, that we are a fault apportionment jurisdiction, and there is no such thing other than in the instance of a pure vicarious liability setting, which is not alleged here, for indemnification.
And that's substantive law, not Illinois procedural law. Your time has expired, so we'll have to move to Weiler,
Your Honor.
Ms. Weiler, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Catherine Weiler. I represent Prate Roofing in this matter. United Fire owed Prate a duty to defend. The district court's ruling should be affirmed. United Fire's focus, as we've been discussing even this morning, is that the claim here cannot somehow exist in the context of construction negligence, and that is simply incorrect. And I think the best starting point for that is to go back to some of the questions that you, Judge Scudder, and you, Judge Hamilton, were asking about the actual language in the complaint here. And Judge Scudder, you
get there.
Yes, go ahead.
If we could talk about what the policy covers.
Yes.
I think it's agreed that this policy rider that was a condition of this subcontracting relationship, and I understand that this is fairly common in the industry, required the named insured, the subcontractor, All Seasons, to obtain a rider to cover the general contractor, Prate, your client, for vicarious liability, respondeat superior liability, to the extent that there could be a claim that your client, Prate, would be responsible for the torts of All Seasons. That's what vicarious liability is. That's what this policy covers.
That's correct.
We all agree on the scope of the coverage.
Yes.
It's very cheap coverage, as I understand it as well, right?
They charge for it. It is what it is.
We understand that the rider is really inexpensive and is very common in these kinds of subcontracting situations or circumstances in the construction industry. And so that's just a background fact. We understand the scope of the coverage to be limited to vicarious liability. So to trigger the duty to defend, even though the duty to defend is broader than the duty to indemnify, to trigger the duty to defend, the underlying complaint must allege facts to suggest an agency relationship, because vicarious liability is agency liability. It arises because of principles of agency law based on the relationship between the parties. Here, the general contractor, your client, and the subcontractor, All Seasons. Do we have any allegations of an agency relationship between your client and All Seasons in the underlying operative complaint?
Yes, Chief Judge Sykes. And that actually is what I was about to start with in response to or related to what Judge Scudder and Judge Hamilton were asking. The complaint itself, and I know the court has this, as counsel said,
well, if you're going to go to paragraph 5, that's not enough. That's just a conclusory allegation. It's not a factual allegation.
Actually, Your Honor, I was going to go to paragraph 3, okay, which states, and I won't take too long reading this. I know the court has it. at the aforesaid time and place, Prate Roofing, individually and through its agents, servants, and employees, was present during the course of the erection, construction, repairs, alteration, et cetera, work. And
I'm looking, there's nothing in that paragraph that refers to an agency relationship between Prate and All Seasons. I'm looking for allegations of an agency relationship between Prate and All Seasons, because that's what's necessary to trigger the duty to defend under this coverage, understanding the limited scope of this coverage, which you've just admitted.
The use of the phrase "and its agents, servants, and employees" is sufficient. That's what the Illinois...
Sufficient. Because that's a boilerplate conclusory allegation. It doesn't suggest an agency relationship between these two parties, which is what's necessary to trigger the duty to defend. And that's what the two Pekin cases from the Intermediate Court of Appeals of Illinois, Pekin versus Centex Homes and Pekin versus Lexington, that's what the point that was lost on those courts. And I don't think the Illinois Supreme Court would make the same error.
Your Honor, I think that Centex and Lexington Station were correct in their analysis of this.
They relied on that boilerplate reference to individually and through its agents, servants, and employees.
Yes,
and
Your Honor.
That's an analytical error for the substantive reasons that vicarious liability is distinct from direct liability and depends on an agency relationship, the basic fundamental difference between agency liability and direct liability for one's own torts. So if the claim here is there was a duty to defend because this complaint provided a factual basis for there to be an agency relationship between Prate and All Seasons, such that All Seasons torts are imputed to Prate, that's just wrong. There aren't any of those allegations in this complaint.
The facts of the complaint, the underlying allegations, Your Honor, concern the relation. I disagree, Your Honor. And I disagree because the description of the relationship between All Seasons and Prate in the complaint, they describe a relationship between these two entities where Prate is responsible in certain respects for the work site, allegedly, and there is a question about whether Prate had anything to do with the activity that was happening at the work site versus All Seasons that was actually coordinating the roofing work at that work site.
Where are the allegations with respect to All Seasons and its relationship with Prate?
It's explained, Your Honor, earlier on in the complaint where they're describing the two entities, the relationship you have early in the complaint, where the events are taking place. You have a discussion about exactly what Prate was responsible for, that the decedent was working for All Seasons, that the decedent was working as a laborer on the roof, and that the
allegations that Prate had a right of control over All Seasons.
That allegation is made in paragraph 4. Yes, Your Honor. To exercise reasonable care in the control of said construction site. Yes, it's there. And that's why this case is so similar to Centex and Lexington Station and why those two cases were correctly decided. And in fact, that is the same type of analysis that the Illinois Supreme Court points to in Kearney. And I realize, Chief Judge Sykes, that Kearney...
Ms. Wheeler, those are Restatement 414 direct liability allegations. I'm looking for allegations of an agency relationship that had a right of control over All Seasons sufficient to create an agency relationship so that All Seasons was acting for its principal, Prate, and principal Prate is liable for its torts. That's what would trigger this coverage, and only that.
That is the language that is included in paragraphs 3 and 4 that we have been discussing, and that is the language that, yes, Judge Hamilton.
Miller, as I understand this problem, we generally, and most state law, I think is different states that I'm familiar with, doesn't try to determine the duty to defend based upon a conclusion about at the outset of the case about who is liable for what and under what theories. Rather, we consider potential exposure. And is there anything in the underlying Ayala estate complaint that forecloses the estate from asserting vicarious liability against Prate for direct negligence by All Seasons?
No, Your Honor.
I would have thought that a plaintiff in those circumstances, as the court noted in the Pekin cases, basically doesn't know enough about the relationships among the various defendants to be able to commit, and therefore tries to keep options open, see what develops during the suit. Now, I would think that if it makes a difference to somebody, it would be possible in the underlying tort suit to try to force the plaintiff to choose one theory or another, or to present a summary judgment motion, for example, that knocks out the possibility of vicarious liability?
Yes, Your Honor. But at that point, I'm sorry, go ahead, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. At that point, you're past the point of analysis of a duty to defend argument, and that is exactly the point here. There is nothing in the complaint that forecloses the possibility of an agency claim, and at that point, the duty to defend is triggered. And I just want to go back to one last thing related to Chief Judge Sykes' questions about the Illinois Supreme Court. The line of cases that we have, these Pekin cases, it's a long line, and it's not just published decisions. There are multiple unpublished decisions, too. These come from, at least as best our research shows, three of the five district courts in the Illinois appellate court. And most importantly, my point to you, Your Honor, is there have been attempts to appeal these to the Illinois Supreme Court. The Illinois Supreme Court has not granted discretionary review over any of these. And I think that suggests that there is not concern, or at least there is not a need felt by the Illinois Supreme Court to intervene and correct a misinterpretation of the law here.
What about cases after Carney?
Yes, all of these cases, every single one of them, came down after Carney. All of the Pekin cases are post-Carney.
Well, the two Pekin cases that are most at issue here, and I guess Pekin must issue a lot of these policies so that every one of these is called Pekin.
Agreed. I'm happy to walk the court through them. There's Centex Homes, which is a 2017 case. There's the Triple A Masonry case, which references, it's not as directly on point, but it certainly references Centex. There's Lexington Station, also a 2017 case. There's a Fourth District case called Core Construction Services from 2019. Again, as an Illinois appellate practitioner, I realized that the appellate court would have my head for referencing these under Rule 23. Excuse me, but there are cases under Rule 23 from 2019, from 2018, from 2017, from different appellate courts, all of them reaching the same conclusion, many of them having given rise to petitions for leave to appeal, all of those PLAs being denied, and they are all post-Carney.
But I think we can all agree as experienced appellate practitioners that state Supreme Courts often, like the U.S. Supreme Court, wait for issues to percolate in the lower court until there is a reason to intervene.
Absolutely.
So I don't think we can draw any conclusions from that. The fact that leave to appeal has been denied, and even the Illinois Intermediate Appellate Courts in these many Pekin decisions admit to a great deal of conceptual confusion in this area that the state Supreme Court attempted to clarify to a degree as to the substantive basis for liability in these construction law cases in the Carney case.
Yes,
so
I agree.
Our job is to, this is a coverage dispute here, and our job is to determine what the state Supreme Court would rule as to this coverage dispute, and whether, knowing what we know from Carney, the state Supreme Court would require some allegation of an agency relationship between the general contractor and the subcontractor to trigger this coverage, which, as everyone agrees, only covers agency liability based on agency law.
And Your Honor, I think the Supreme Court in Carney did precisely that. And if I may, it's in paragraph 38 of the Carney decision. It's the last, one of the last sentences, and it states, agency law, under which an employer may be vicariously liable for the torts of its employees, is distinct from the principles encompassed in section 414, under which an employer is directly liable for its own negligence. In short, section 414 takes over where agency law ends. And what
I'm very familiar with that phrase because I wrote it.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, you did. Certainly. And you absolutely correctly anticipated in Aguirre how the Illinois Supreme Court would decide this issue. However,
and that works against you here because the court is recognizing that there's a distinction and a sharp distinction between agency liability, vicarious liability, respondeat superior liability, goes by different names, and direct liability, and so would require some allegations of an agency relationship in the underlying complaint in order to trigger a duty to defend for this kind of coverage.
And as the Illinois Appellate Court has held, the language in the complaint here, similar language, is sufficient to do that. I see that my time is up. If there are no further questions from the court, we ask that the court affirm the district court.
All right, thank you very much. Mr. Miller, your time had expired. You may have a minute of extra time if you have any closing thoughts.
I have many closing thoughts, but I will condense them down to this. As Chief Judge Sykes has said, looking at Aguirre and looking and addressing Judge Hamilton's concerns, there is no possibility of vicarious liability here where we have an admission, a judicial admission, that the relationship was that of independent contractor to contractor, and we also have contribution claims.
Mr. Miller, I don't understand that point. You say there's a judicial admission. What I see is a litigation strategy that says we think we're entitled to win on this ground, but we know that we might lose on that basis. So we want to be prepared to defend on alternative grounds as well.
As far as the Rule 36 request, I was seeking information as to whether we are dealing with joint tortfeasors to whom the remedy of contribution applies. We also have here a settlement of the case, which proves out that this was fault apportionment. And following the settlement, there could clearly be no attorney's fees, because any settlement under an agency theory, as they would have it, automatically released Prate.
Well, if that's right, why can't you all just file that motion to get Prate out of the case?
Because we weren't defending Prate, and because the attorneys that were defending Prate didn't want to do that because they knew that there was no agency claim there, that this was a fault apportionment claim, and therefore they wanted continued defending. They would not have prevailed on that claim because the plaintiff never made an agency claim. And that's what we're talking about here. There are no allegations other than the boilerplate, bold-faced agent, officer, and employee claim to support an agency relationship that could or might trigger the vicarious liability endorsement in question. And if you ever assume the defense of a party under an endorsement such as that, then the issue becomes, when in the world do you reach the point on indemnification where the plaintiff says that this is not an agency claim and therefore you are exonerated from the duty to defend? And Illinois law also says if you accept the defense, and it turns out that the acceptance of the defense was in error, then you are entitled under the general agent's case to recover back your attorney's fees. So there was clearly no agency relationship here, and we respectfully submit that the decision below should be reversed in all respects as to the initial duty to defend and as to any duty to defend after United Fire paid its policy limits and obtained releases for its named insured All Seasons.
All right. Thank you very much. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under